Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. More people have looked through the Zeiss refracting telescope at Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles than any other instrument on the planet. And I'm one of the fortunate multitude. When I was a kid, my father, Al Schlom, now 95 years old, took me for my first visit to the iconic landmark overlooking the LA Basin and the Hollywood Hills. I'll never forget the first planetarium show I saw there about the Christmas star and my first view through that telescope. It was there that my love of the night sky was truly born. I'm joined this week by one of my personal heroes, Dr. Edwin C. Krupp, the longtime director of the observatory and the driving force behind its renovation project in the early 2000s, that was also spearheaded by another hero of mine, the late great Leonard Nimoy, also known as Mr. Spock from Star Trek. Even if you've never been to Griffith Observatory, and it's likely you have, it's nearly certain that you've seen it in the multitude of Hollywood movies, TV shows, and commercials that have used it as a setting. Built in 1935 and funded by Griffith J. Griffith, a multimillionaire philanthropist who served prison time for nearly murdering his wife in a real-life scene out of a Hollywood movie, the observatory is free to the public and operated by the L.A. Department of Parks and Recreation. It was immortalized in the 1955 film Rebel Without a Cause, starring James Dean, Natalie Wood, and Sal Mineo. A bust of James Dean with the Hollywood sign in the background is one of the greatest places to take a selfie in L.A. But it is astronomy and science, the stars and the heavens, that are truly the actors on the stage at Griffith Observatory, and there's no one more versed in the history and mission of that facility than our guest, Edwin C. Krupp. Ed earned his degrees in astronomy from, appropriately enough, UCLA, under the legendary astrophysicist George Abel, where he studied galaxies beyond the Milky Way. And as you'll hear later, there's an amazing exhibit at the observatory featuring a lifelike statue of Albert Einstein that brings that research to life. So let's drive up past the Greek Theater through Griffith Park to take a virtual tour of Griffith Observatory with our guest, director of that observatory, Dr. Edwin C. Krupp. Ed Krupp, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks an awful lot. Blue is a very fine color for dots and anything else, actually, in the universe.
Especially, you know, when viewed from deep space.
You bet.
You look back at the Earth from the edge of the solar system, that pale blue dot. I have to tell you, this is just a real pleasure for me because you've been a personal hero of mine for many years.
Very kind of you to say that. Of course, it implies an extraordinary responsibility on my part. I'm going to deny it all, but I'll do my best.
I'm sure you will. Well, I'd like to start out because this is about both you and Griffith Observatory, but let's start with the observatory. For our listeners who, you know, aren't from the LA area, never been there, let's start with a little brief history. How did this amazing facility come about? How did Griffith Observatory get its genesis?
Sure. Griffith Observatory is, of course, a public observatory, has telescopes, a planetarium, a museum exhibits and such in a spectacular location overlooking Los Angeles Basin. Dates back to 1935, opened on the 14th of May, 1935, as the gift of Colonel Griffith J. Griffith, who was an entrepreneur and a resident of Los Angeles prior to that time. Griffith actually died in 1919, but he earlier had given this extraordinary amount of property, which is now Griffith Park, a huge municipal park, claimed, in fact, to be the largest municipal park in the country, although people argue about such things. Later in his life, Colonel Griffith, being interested in astronomy and many things, had the good fortune to go up to Mount Wilson. Those days it was a lot harder than it is now, and had access to the 60-inch telescope, which was the largest telescope in the world at the time. And he also had a chance, of all things, to look through that telescope, something you wouldn't normally do even then as a professional astronomer. But he had the good fortune for that. And he is quoted as saying, if all mankind could look through that telescope, it would change the world. And clearly he was thinking about much more than astronomy there, but astronomy was the lost leader. And so he decided he would, in fact, build a public observatory because the whole world couldn't go up to Mount Wilson and look through that telescope. And so he got this idea of building a public observatory for everybody and spelled out in rather considerable detail, ultimately in his will, what should be incorporated into it. And then years after his death, from 1919 to 1935, went through all of the design and the various issues that had to transpire until the place was open, obviously about 85 years ago this year.
Wow. And it's interesting. You mentioned Mount Wilson, and we should say that recently, you know, it was pretty scary. I was worried we might lose that national treasure with a bear fire there. So I'm so glad that they were able to save it because, as I think you have said, that's really where our modern understanding of the universe was born, was on that mountaintop across the city. East of Griffith Observatory.
You're absolutely on the money there. California was really kind of the Alexandria of astronomy in the beginning of the 20th century, and Mount Wilson was right there in the middle of it. And among the most important things that happened there, I think you could argue it was the most important thing, was the discovery of the modern universe, the fact that the universe is evolving, is changing in time. And we all kind of take that for granted now, but had we been alive then, it would have been a very different sensibility about things. That is not how people used to look at the universe, and it was earth-shaking when Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe is expanding through his measurements of the recession rates of galaxies and comparing them to distances.
Yeah, and then another interesting connection there is that we should talk about George Ellery Hale, who was, you know, the person that basically founded that observatory and then later Mount Palomar. And there's a person whose story always has fascinated me, and that's Russell Porter.
Yeah.
Because his drawings of the telescopes, of the Hale telescope on Mount Palomar, as a kid, I hung those up in my bedroom. And he also was part of the Griffith Observatory story.
That's all exactly true. And we've obviously got to credit you for your fine aesthetic judgment as a youth to put those Russell Porter drawings. Those black and white drawings, most of them, of course, were engineering type drawings in a way, that in the sense they're remarkably accurate. And yet they had this visionary quality that would allow anybody who looked at them to get a sense of what the world's largest telescope was going to look like on Palomar Mountain there, the 200-inch Hale reflector. And as you said, that telescope, Mount Wilson, Yerkes before it out at Williams Bay in Wisconsin near Chicago, these were all built and really designed in that sense by George Ellery Hale. And he's an American scientist who really should be a household name, but isn't. It's not famous. You know, he doesn't have the Hubble Space Telescope named after him or anything, but American astronomy would be a shadow of itself without George Ellery Hale, not just for telescope building, but the whole development of concepts. What should we be concerned about? And of course, as your question was leading, George Ellery Hale also played a key role with the development of Griffith Observatory in that Russell Porter, who was a polar explorer and an artist and an engineer and all kinds of things, was working for Hale and doing the drawings that you described, as well as many other tasks for which he was most peculiarly suited, just with his specialized abilities. And he got assigned to work on the Griffith Observatory project, kind of in its infancy, to assist the architects. And so conceived of the interiors and the exterior, produced all kinds of Griffith Observatories that wound up never existing because he was was figuring options. So it could look like this and it could look like that, and it might have a floor plan like this. And out of all of those, then that ultimately in conjunction with the architects came the very classy building that is Griffith Observatory today. And we would, in fact, not have the kind of instrumentation that we have, really the kind of mission that we have toward public astronomy, had not Russell Porter been involved. He was the one who conceived many of the original exhibits. And by that, I mean the interactions with instruments on this hilltop. That notion was very much Porter's.
Wow. And, you know, George Ellery Hale has always been somebody I've found just to be an amazing, heroic person, battled all kinds of chronic mental illness issues. And I was talking to Anne Druyan recently, the creator and writer of Cosmos, the new Cosmos, Possible Worlds, that's on right now. And I mentioned to her and her son, Sam Sagan, I said, when you do the next version of Cosmos, the next one, you really should tell the story of George Ellery Hale, because it's fascinating.
Yeah, you're on the money. And, the story has intricacies that most of us never think about. You've got telescopes left on mountaintops now, and they are icons of science and people know about them. But getting them there is no easy trick. And it's not just physically of building them and solving the problems of giant mirrors and all that, just financing them. And George Ellery Hale was a master at persuading people with resources to donate the money in order to build the kinds of instrumentation he had the visionary acumen to imagine. And so people like Andrew Carnegie, of course, were cultivated by him repeatedly. And as a result, that kind of human touch, as well as the scientific aspect of Hale, is what made American astronomy possible in the 20th century.
Yeah, and in a sense, it was Griffith Observatory through the years that helped bring that story of what was going on those mountaintops, Mount Wilson and Mount Palomar, to bring that story to the people and let us experience it, you know, through all of the wonderful exhibits there. But before I get in more into that, it's the most beautiful building. Could you just describe to us, you know, what kind of architecture it is? Because it's just gorgeous.
Yeah, the observatory is fortunate to be located on the south slope of Mount Hollywood. So it's a highly visible building, can be seen from the entire basin. And of course, you can see the entire Los Angeles basin from it. And that visibility winds up affecting everyone's mentality. You have to be very careful what you do with this building, because it's so visible and its architecture is so distinctive. You have to imagine, if you've never seen it, a building that is primarily designed with a profile of three domes. That is, a large dome in the middle and a pair of smaller domes, one on either side, and all of them mounted on what's essentially a rectangular structure. The south side of the building that heads out over the city has almost the appearance of the bow of a ship going out over the water, with these big domes topping it. But you see this very characteristic three-dome profile. And the architecture is quite an interesting mix. People very often, for shorthand, call it something like Art Deco 30s style. It really is 30s modern classical revival Beaux-Arts. It's a mix of all of those architectural styles. And it's not just the architecture that makes it what it is. It's the grounds, it's the placement, it's the lawns. All of those things were combined to give the place a particular feel. Not easy to get to. You have to kind of work to get up the mountain and reach the observatory, but then you're rewarded with this really extraordinary classic building that it looks classy, and it's classy for everybody. It's not an elitist building, but it's high end for everybody.
And it has those iconic views of Los Angeles. And you know, often I'm watching television and I'll see a commercial for a car company or something, and the view out, and I go, oh, I know where that is.
You know, the fact is that you've spotlighted a really important part of the observatory and why it is the way that it is. And you've done that by mentioning, of course, seeing it on television or motion pictures. And in fact, the very first appearance of Griffith Observatory in a motion picture was for a picture that was produced before the observatory even opened. It was released in 1935. Gene Autry, Saturday matinee, Western singing cowboy thriller called The Phantom Empire. And that was the observatory's first appearance in films. But the reason that's significant is not just as a cinematic moment, of course, but the observatory has had a connection with Hollywood, Hollywood technology, Hollywood sensibilities, Hollywood storytelling, all of its career. And it's gone back and forth where Hollywood is drawn on the observatory as a set or also for information. And likewise, the observatory has learned things about technology and storytelling and the other things that are incorporated into exhibits and shows here. So that is one of the key factors that makes Griffith Observatory what it is. The other two are very simple. The first one is location, location, location. It is that spotlight on the hill. It is the best piece of public observatory real estate on the planet. And then the other one that people don't often think about, but is absolutely crucial. Griffith Observatory is owned and operated by the City of Los Angeles, Department of Recreation and Parks. It is, in fact, not just a public observatory, it's owned by the public. And that reflects Colonel Griffith's original populist sensibility. And so everybody that comes up here, they may not be consciously aware that as taxpayers and residents, they own it, but they act like they own it. They behave as though it belongs to them, and it does, and they behave well. It should belong to them, and it does. So those things all affect the way the observatory operates in the public arena.
Well, before I forget, I told my father, who's going to be 95 here in a month, I was going to interview you and who you are, and he said, oh, be sure you tell him that I used to ride my horse from Burbank up to the observatory back in the 1950s.
Good for him. And let me just confirm, you actually can still do that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and they've even got a new bridge across the river just for equestrians. So it's easier than ever to do that. But yeah, we get some horses up here. And congratulate him on 95. That's thrilling.
If you're just joining us, our guest is the longtime director of the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles, Ed Krupp. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's get back now to our conversation with Dr. Edwin C. Krupp as we talk about one of LA's greatest cultural treasures, the Griffith Observatory.
I grew up in the museums of Chicago and moved to Southern California when my father came out here to work on rockets and missiles in the space program. So he was an engineer, and he took a job first at Lockheed and later, in fact, on the Apollo program. And space shuttle and such. So once we got out here, and that 1957, and pretty soon checking out the various attractions and stuff, went up to Griffith Observatory, and I was greatly disappointed. Even though I was already committed in my heart to be an astronomer. The place looked run down. There were huge rusty stains down the large copper dome over the planetarium. I now know what caused those. It was a police antenna up on the top that had been allowed to rust. Should never have been put up there in the first place. But these things happen. And it was years before we could ever deal with it. So at the beginning, I wasn't that interested in Griffith Observatory and did not return to the observatory until I was in graduate school. And my advisor made me take a job here.
And who was your advisor? Because I think he's a pretty famous astronomer.
That's Dr. George Abel, who was well known particularly for observational cosmology, but also for the most successful modern textbook, college textbook on astronomy, and also one of the most remarkable and entertaining people I ever had the pleasure to know. I first met him at the summer science program when I was a student there in 61, and that was one of the reasons I decided to go to UCLA as a grad student. I wanted to be his student.
And you just mentioned the summer science program, and my understanding is that was really a formative experience for you.
No question. It was a relatively new educational initiative at the time. It was an intense summer program for high school juniors who were particularly interested in and capable in science and math and related topics. Didn't mean everybody that attended was going to turn into an astronomer, but everybody that did, about 30 each summer, at the beginning of this thing, were motivated. It all came out of Sputnik and the electrification towards science and science education after the first satellite from the Soviets went up. So the summer science program began in 59, and I attended it in 61. And the intensity of the experience and the direct just daily interaction with two college professors and then all of these other kids my age who were equally motivated did in fact have a very important effect on me.
And then, okay, after your first initial disappointment with Griffith Observatory, you do come back. And what was your first actual job there?
My first responsibility was really as a part-time planetarium lecturer. George Abel called me into his office one day, and he'd always been helpful to me. And he said, "Ed, there is an opening for a planetarium lecture at Griffith Observatory. I think you should take it." And I nodded to him very dutifully, as if I were paying attention, but I had no interest in it. I was a serious astronomer, and I couldn't be messing around with Griffith Observatory. And so I ignored him. And about 3 weeks later, he called me into his office again and said, "Ed, there is an opening for a planetarium lecture at Griffith Observatory. I think you ought to take it." So I got the message the second time and then interviewed with Leon Hall, who was the associate director and in charge of the place at the time. And he hired me to do morning school programs. They were traumatic at the start, you know, planetarium filled with 660 school kids all at once. And suddenly you've not only got to master the equipment in the room, the Zeiss planetarium, all the special effects projectors, but 660 kids. But survival demands that you do. And I gradually grew to actually think that it was pretty nifty.
Yeah, I believe you. Was it your wife you told? It was like, this is too much like showbiz. But then you kind of realized that was, you know, hey, that's part of.
It really was an epiphany. I didn't like it because it was like show business, and it really felt that way. But as it became possible to be better, I realized it was really fun. And so I told her then, yep, it looks like it's like show business, as if I always knew that and it was always a good thing.
Well, let me tell you about my first experience there. When I was a child, this would have been in the 1960s. My father took me up there, who loved to take me to places around Los Angeles, and that was one of the places he wanted to take me. And I got to see one of the planetarium programs, and I was just enthralled by the wonderful voice of the planetarium lecturer and explaining what was going on and seeing the lights go down as if it was sunset. And all of a sudden, it's like this night sky came alive that I had never seen, because as a kid in L.A., you don't really see stars. And then I got to go look through that wonderful telescope, the Zeiss telescope. And I'm not sure, but I think it was Albireo that it was trained on. Uh-huh. It was some kind of a double star. And, you know, I remember the operator telling me this, you know, look up there, there's a star. Well, now look through here and there's two, and they were, you know, there was color to them. And I was just like, wow, I want one of these. And so, you know, that was when I started bugging my parents for a telescope for Christmas. And I've had a telescope really ever since. And I fell in love with astronomy that night at Griffith Observatory. And, you know, the reason I'm here talking to you today is because of that experience and many after that at the observatory, because I wanted to go back again and again and take it all in. My favorite things were just so many things, like where you could weigh yourself on the other planets. And the Foucault pendulum was, mm-hmm. is just that, that was like one of those things where once I understood what was really going on, that blew my mind. Could you tell us about the Foucault pendulum?
Sure. The Foucault pendulum is on the historic level completed in 2006, was a $93 million addition and renovation to the place that didn't even exist. But the Foucault pendulum has been there from the beginning. And it's an instrument, so it's operating and demonstrating with real information in real time a fundamental thing that's happening to us all, and that is the Earth is turning. This pendulum is suspended from the ceiling, you know, so it goes up there at 40 feet or so in the air, giant, massive brass ball that swings back and forth. And we set up a kind of a tray of pegs in front of it once it gets started swinging, because over time, what you see is that the swing of the pendulum changes direction and starts knocking over pegs, first one and then maybe 5 minutes later another, which all indicate, as one more peg goes down, that the pendulum wasn't swinging in the same place where you saw it a little bit before. Well, it's not really the pendulum that is changing direction. In fact, Newton's laws tell us that it can't. Once you start, it's just going to go back and forth in the same direction. And so the only way that it can look like it's changing direction is if the floor is turning underneath it. And that's exactly what is happening. And that's happening because the Earth is turning. So there, in real time, you have this monumental instrument that looks to many people like some kind of weird giant clock or so, you know, but isn't. And is demonstrating a fundamental principle about the planet right before your very eyes. It's in, of course, an extraordinary architectural environment. There, the Hugo Ballin murals overhead, all of the fine travertine surfaces and other metals. As I said before, it's the architecture, the interiors, they're high-end surfaces and images for everybody. It's really the classiest Foucault pendulum on the planet. I've actually collected Foucault pendulum by default, going around to places and seeing them, but there's none really as elegant as that one at Griffith Observatory.
Yeah, because it's just this wonderful combination of beautiful artwork and architecture and the principles of demonstrating the rotation of the Earth right there in front of your eyes. It's just, yeah. It's one of the amazing things. And what I love about it is it's an original instrument to the observatory.
Yeah. Russell Porter designed, by the way. I mean, his conceptions of that room. And your anecdote about Albireo and seeing it through the Zeiss, you must know, you in that act confirmed exactly what Colonel Griffith wanted to have happen. The direct experience of the cosmos, those photons out in the universe to your eyes, transforms your life. And that's what interested him.
Yeah, for a lot of people, it's the first view of Saturn. But,
oh, yeah.
But for me, it was Albireo, because that was what was playing that night. And, yeah. And you know, it was also just the telescope itself, the magnificence of that instrument. And I saw something the other day that I found to be fascinating. Isn't that telescope like a world record holder?
It surely is. You know, it's not the biggest telescope in the world. It is a refractor, a very unstylish telescope, really, perfect for Griffith Observatory and public viewing, but it's not the kind of instrument you would use today to gather buckets full of light to see the most distant things in the universe and the faintest things. But that telescope, in its way, is as distinguished as any, because more people have looked through that telescope than any telescope on the planet.
That's amazing. Do you have any sense of how many?
Oh yeah, we're well over the 1.5 million mark. I mean, it was like 1.2 million about 4 years ago. So I think if it weren't for COVID-19, we'd probably be well over 2 million by now.
Yeah, I want my badge that says I was number 241,312.
I don't blame you. Yeah.
Well, you know, then you become the director. How did that happen?
Like many things in life, it's unexpected, perhaps a mistake. I was working as a part-time planetarium lecturer while I was in grad school. I was teaching part-time down at El Camino College and then also just trying to finish up grad school. And so as that looked like it was going to come to its proper finish, I started applying for jobs at various places. I imagined myself to be a professor of astronomy at some small liberal arts college somewhere and carrying out a modest research program and teaching astronomy and such. But when I applied, and I applied to lots of places, the fact is, I like so many, just out of graduate school, you really are inexperienced and not necessarily at the top of anybody's list. And as it turned out, there was only one job available to me at the time, and that was as curator of Griffith Observatory. The curator position had gone empty, had been vacated, and so I was around at the time, and again, thanks to my advisor, George Abel, who helped engineer that, but also Bill Kaufman, who was the director at that time. I was hired as the curator to take care of exhibits and related things, in part to design some new exhibits for the place. And that I took seriously, but I didn't expect to stick around. I thought, well, this is one of those things I'll do for a few years until I get enough experience so that I can go and do what I think I'm supposed to do. And as it turned out, that's just not what happened. A couple of years later, there were some instabilities and changes in the place. And before I knew it, the city had asked me to take on the task of acting as director for a period of time. And then they appointed me as the director. And that was, I started that task in 74. So I've been doing that since then.
Well, Ed, I imagine there are many, many things, but can you think of maybe like one or two things that come to mind of like one of your favorite memories? If you were, you know, to say, what was one of my favorite moments being, you know, here at the observatory? Can you think of one that pops into your head?
Well, yeah, there's of course, as you say, several, but let me see if I can highlight a couple of things. We were talking about views for the telescope, and it would be remiss if I didn't just mention, because I soon learned that looking through the telescope was fine, but what was much more extraordinary was seeing other people look through the telescope. And there was an occasion where I saw a young girl looking through the telescope for the first time, and she was seeing Saturn in that case. And she turned around with this utterly transfigured look on her face, clear happiness. I mean, it was astonishing. And that just remains in my mind forever. Just to see the moment when that light goes on in someone's head and heart. Certainly the completion of the observatory's renovation and expansion it was such a long haul to get to that point. Really, the very first memo I wrote about needing to do things to keep the observatory operating with major capital expenses was way back in 78. And if you think about the fact that we didn't actually even get started until 2002, master plan in 1990, and then eventually you solve the problems of the money and so on, and go into construction. But the completion of all of that was, of course, very, very satisfying. And then the fact is, you can't diminish the impact of things like Halley's Comet, Hale-Bopp. Griffith Observatory showed Halley's Comet through a telescope to more people than any place else on the Earth. Same thing with Hale-Bopp and Comet Halkatake. Well, that meant night after night after night, you would see crowds descending on the observatory. And of course, we had to respond to them with dozens of telescopes all over the place, along the edge and all over the front lawn. And to see this massive motivation of people wanting to connect with the sky, it just never, never leaves.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Edwin C. Krupp. He's the director of the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to our virtual visit to Griffith Observatory in LA with our guest, the longtime tour guide to that iconic perch above Los Angeles, Observatory Director Ed Krupp. Could you take us on like an audio tour of the newer exhibits, the stuff that's down below the observatory now?
Yeah, Griffith Observatory, it was never a big building. And when we were doing the renovation and the expansion and the design for that, our primary goal was improving the visitor experience. We didn't want more visitors. We wanted the visitors that come here to have a better time of it, not to be crowded. And if you think about this place and its visibility and its distinctive identity, you realize that our options were very limited in terms of what we could do. You couldn't really put another building out in front of the observatory. I mean, it would just ruin the appearance of the place. And you couldn't put another building elsewhere in the park, you know, sort of like an addition that wasn't part of the main structure. And that actually left only one option, which was to go underground. And so that is what we did. There was a huge pit dug in the front lawn, in front of the observatory, from the north entrance, about halfway to the astronomer's monument. And that became the Gunther Depths of Space. And the Depths of Space emphasizes, with its exhibits and the experiences that they provide, it really emphasizes how the cosmos has changed since a watershed event in the history of the Earth, in the history of astronomy, and of course, in the history of our own experience. And that is the inauguration of the space age, of putting satellites in orbit and then space probes to other worlds, and of course, even people landing on another world for the first time in the 4.5 billion year history of the planet. That's what occurred. So in that area, we emphasize the transformations of perspective that have occurred. And we do that with a number of key exhibits. And without really getting crucially into each and every one, I would be remiss if I didn't mention probably the most astounding element of the Gunther Depths of Space, which is the big picture. The big picture is a wall. A wall that is 150 feet long and 20 feet high and made entirely of porcelain enamel on steel panels. Those panels are each about 5 feet by 3 feet, and they are fitted perfectly so that you really don't detect the seams. And the reason that's important is they are all one astronomical image. It is, in fact, the largest astronomical image in the world. It is of a very particularly selected spot in the sky. It's of the core of the Virgo cluster of galaxies. And so when you look at the big picture, and you can go right up to it. You can even touch it if you want, because it's made of materials that aren't going to break or in some way degrade. There are 2 million objects recorded on that. You can walk right up to them and look at the faintest things that the telescope that recorded that image could see. That was up on Palomar Mountain. That was the Samuel Ocean telescope, once called the 48-inch Schmidt telescope. And that scanned that region, a small region of the sky in the Virgo cluster. George Dragowski at Caltech and his team did that for us. And this tiny, tiny little bit of sky, just 1/1000th of the entire sky, blown up to this size and contains 2 million objects, 1 million of which are galaxies outside of our own Milky Way galaxy. So the scale of this is extraordinary, and you can see it directly with your own senses. I mean, just again, you can not only walk up to it, but across the room from the edge of space, an elevated platform, there are telescopes there that allow you to, inside the building, to look across the room and pick out details way up in parts of the that wall that you couldn't access from below. And yet that entire wall, with everything that it contains, is no more of the sky than what I cover up with my finger when I raise it at arm's length. It's just the tiniest little portion of sky, and yet it is filled with all of those objects and at this extraordinary cosmic distance of the galaxies and clusters of galaxies at the limit of our telescope's ability to detect them. So it really is an exercise in cosmic perspective and, in fact, a demonstration of the way in which we are trying very hard to turn the universe into a neighborhood.
Yeah, and it reminds me of the power of, you know, viewing the Hubble Deep Field, which is the same kind of experience. Yeah. But you also have a permanent visitor there that kind of helps you understand that experience of holding your finger out there. Could you tell us about him?
You bet. Right down on the floor, we have a statue. And I should preface that by saying the observatory has had famous astronomers, really great visitors from the beginning. That's the Astronomer's Monument. It's the only part of the observatory that was not financed by Colonel Griffith's gift. The Works Projects Administration during the Depression was a source of the funding for this a monument that has six of the world's most famous astronomers out on the front lawn. But we had this tradition of statues of astronomers out there. And when we were doing the planning for the new area, we thought this would be a good opportunity to add somebody. And so, in fact, we commissioned a bronze statue, full size, sitting on the bench of Albert Einstein. And he is holding up his hand with one finger extended to make the point that I just did a minute ago, that big picture that's across from him in the room right there is just a finger's worth of the entire sky, and yet, of course, is overwhelming in its content.
And, of course, it's his general theory of relativity that gives us insight into the expansion of the universe and of galaxies. As Carl Sagan once said, you know, that's really nature on the grandest scale.
You see the fundamental structure of the universe when you look at galaxies and clusters of galaxies, and we understand them best, just as you said, not with the physics that came with Isaac Newton, terribly important, and of course it's great if you need to put up a satellite, but Albert Einstein was responsible for an extraordinary refinement of our understanding, and we all depend on it today. We depend on relativity for the way instruments and satellites and things work now. We're just not conscious of it. But Albert Einstein clearly deserves the credit he has gotten. Well, Time magazine declared him the man of the century at the end of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, my GPS that helps me navigate when I go on long trips is, you know, dependent on that very principle. The history, and you mentioning the 48-inch Schmidt telescope, the Ocean telescope, and he's also the person that the planetarium's named after, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, he was an entrepreneur or a philanthropist. And it's so interesting to think about, you know, that that's another connection to Russell Porter. You know, there again, you know, it's like he keeps coming back into our story. And I find that fascinating. The history of this place is just so rich. And I have to, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about a certain movie that was made there in 1955.
I understand well. And that, you know, Griffith Observatory embraces its cinematic career. We believe we ought to have a star out there on the boulevard because we've been in so many films. But of course, you have in mind James Dean, Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah, with the gorgeous Natalie Wood in it.
We love that movie. There's even a monument out on the pedestal. It's very strategically located. So when you are out there by that monument with a bust of James Dean on the top of this pillar, this column, it's not a monument for James Dean, although he epitomizes the film. It's a monument to the film. And of course, the Hollywood sign is in the same view as you're looking out there. But the reason that we're so charmed by that film, that is the first film that actually had Griffith Observatory star as Griffith Observatory. It had always been something else in other motion pictures before that, the Palace of Ming the Merciless or Superman's Fortress of Solitude or whatever it might be in whatever script. But in Rebel Without a Cause, of course, a film that was set in Los Angeles, and it's not just that the Observatory played itself. The whole theme of that movie was an embrace of cosmic perspective and how human beings are very, very tiny compared to the universe, and that contrast between the emotional entanglements that we have and, of course, the universe that operate on a very different scale. So the theme of that film was as allied with, in a sense, the purpose, the mission, the character of Griffith Observatory, as was the observatory itself.
Wow. Well, there's just, Ed, there's so many wonderful things at that observatory that we could just go on and on and on. And I have to say that, you know, if I was just to go say, if you could go to one place only, to learn as much as you can about science and astronomy in particular, but science in general, because, you know, we haven't even touched on the Tesla coil and all the neat things that you can see there, that Griffith Observatory is that magical place where you can get just about everything. And, you know, the sad thing is now with COVID is, you know, the purpose of the observatory is for it to be there for people to experience. What kinds of things briefly are you doing, you know, as outreach now that you can't have people, you know, on site?
Yeah, we closed on March 13th, 2020. And obviously have remained closed through the entire duration of this so far. It is, in fact, heartbreaking because this place is designed for people to be on the grounds in the building, filling it. It's the most visited public observatory in the world. And of course, now it can't operate that way. There are a couple of areas where we're working. The observatory has always had a very, very tiny staff. And so redirecting resources is tricky business, but that's actually the business we're in now. One thing that we have been doing already, well before COVID-19, was live streaming certain programs. Our monthly All Space Considered program would go out live stream, and then special events, whether they're eclipses, transit of Venus, whatever it might be, that would come up where we would be well positioned to have that event carried by our telescopes and such out over to the entire world. We've done that live streaming. And of course, through this period, we've continued with these intermittent events like this. But one of the great interruptions, and it's been difficult even to know quite how to cope with it because all of the agencies that are involved don't know, is our morning school program for fifth graders. We would, in fact, have over a course of the school year, 28,000 school kids come up here every morning. A group of them are roughly in the neighborhood of 600 and move through different parts of the building, the Samuel Ocean Planetarium, Let's make a comet in the Leonard Nimoy Event Horizon, where we actually manufacture a comet in the classroom, and then other demonstrations, as well as a direct experience with observing. All of those things, an in-person experience, and of course, the schools aren't in person themselves right now, and we aren't either. So as a consequence, now we are right now developing school program modules for the fifth grade, just like our regular program, that we expect to prototype. Actually, the first one out next month in November, with the goal, in fact, of them being able to reach schools routinely who are all online. So if you imagine the challenge, you've got kids in the classroom who aren't in the classroom. They're all on computers somewhere, connected by Zoom or something. And our job is to bring in a Griffith Observatory experience to that group of students, one after another, throughout the day, one day after another. We have in mind a set of modules, including even a planetarium show that won't duplicate as exactly what you get when you're in the Samuel Ocean Planetarium here, but at least will provide part of that experience at this really difficult time, I think, for kids, where they're not able to have the direct encounter with experiences that they really should be having. So that is a major initiative for us, and we expect that as we proceed with that, that will expand into other programming online that goes beyond Los Angeles, so that when we're back in business again on the ground with people coming up here and being able to come in the building and use it like they always have, the reach of Griffith Observatory through live stream programming, we expect to be worldwide.
Well, I can't think of a better organization to do that kind of astronomy and science education than you guys. And we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and just going, touching on all of the wonderful things that happen and have happened over the years at Griffith Observatory. And thanks for your service, because your work there has definitely touched my life and the lives of many thousands of other people. And I'm sure there are some professional astronomers out there that, you know, they caught the bug from your observatory.
Thanks much. We just saw a news story about a woman involved with the discovery of phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus, and she credits her interest in astronomy to a visit to Griffith Observatory.
Thanks once again to our guest, Dr. Ed Krupp, director of the Griffith Observatory. Time went by so quickly with him that I didn't even get to ask about one of his greatest passions, the study of astronomy by ancient cultures. So I'm thinking we'll get Ed back with us again someday soon. In the meantime, I hope you can visit the Griffith Observatory once they reopen it. And if not, rent Rebel Without a Cause and watch the stars come out from 1955. James Dean, Natalie Wood, and of course, the Observatory. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We are distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.